Plants make people happy. Plant friends, you and I both know this. Obviously, this phrase resonates with people as the hashtag plants make people happy has almost 8 million posts so far. And there's a reason, it's just true. Plants and nature and the act of witnessing life itself in plants through plant care makes people happy, makes people feel more connected, more empowered, more joyful. The plant-person connection is hard to explain, yet everyone knows it exists. If you've cared for a plant, you know that plant-person connection is real. We all feel it with our plant collection. We all feel that pride around it. Our heart swells with new growth, and sometimes it even grieves the losses of our plant collection. Caring for plants has been my single most effective tool for wellness in my life, hands down. And believe me, I have tried all of it, every type of self-help, self-care, wellness modality, and plants win by miles. Over the last year and a half, I've dove rather deeply into exploring this plant-person connection and the why behind it, reading several incredibly inspiring books, one of them being written by our special guest today, Sue. The Well Garden Mind by Dr. Sue Stewart-Smith took me on a journey in Sue's exploration of this plant-person connection. And reading the book just made me feel so seen and spoke so directly to my heart. I just knew after reading it that I had to have Sue on the show so we could dive deeper. She is a tremendously special lady. I hope her words resonate with you as much as they do with me. So plant friends, welcome to episode 127 of
Blue Mangrove Radio.
Plant friends, I hope you've had beautifully planty weeks and that you have enjoyed meeting my new plant friend, Melody, on our latest episode. I hope you love her as much as I do. We've had so much fun in her garden this month. You know, it's June in the Catskills. We've been cultivating her land for the last couple of months when it's coming out of winter dormancy. And now the garden is just really starting to come alive. She has so many flowers, native pollinators. It's just... oh, it's a dream. And personally, I'm noticing some tender new leaves in my collection. I've been incubating a variegated Monstera albo node that a listener, Joey, sent me that has finally sprouted some roots after months of nothing. So finally experiencing some new growth in my plant collection, which has been super fun because my plants have not enjoyed the winter in our cabin at all. They hate it here. So very nice to see them waking back up again. Speaking of growing, thank you to our growing community of Patreon plant friends, the newest ones, Danielle, Courtney, and Victoria. Thank you, plant friends, for joining the network of plant friends across the globe that support Bloom and Grow Radio on a monetary basis to help me get this podcast to as many planty ears as possible around the world. But anyway, let's talk about our guest today, Sue Stewart-Smith, Dr. Sue Stewart-Smith. She has a much nicer accent than me. She's English. She's a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist that recently wrote the book that came out in 2020, The Well Garden Mind. I found out about her. I listened to a lecture she gave at New York Botanical Garden online. I read her book. I just freaking loved it. The whole book is highlighted and underlined, and I just knew that I needed to kind of take this conversation deeper with her. So without further ado, I'll let you fall in love with Sue the way I have, and let's get to this conversation. So here we go. Welcome to the podcast, Sue. I'm so excited to have you here today.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be joining you, Maria.
I have known about you for a while. I saw you give a lecture online at the New York Botanical Garden, which led me to getting your book and absolutely falling in love with this book that you wrote and you and your garden through it. So for those listeners who might not have read The Well-Gardened Mind yet, can you tell us a little bit about how you became the amazing plant lady, author, psychiatrist that you are today?
Oh my goodness. It's been quite a journey, really, actually. I suppose the first thing that's worth saying is that I wasn't at all a gardener when I was young. And it was only when I got married to my husband, Tom, who was at that point training to be a garden designer. And he's since gone on to have a very successful career. And we got the opportunity early in our marriage to take on a barn on some land that his parents owned. And we created a home there. And it was surrounded by an arable field. Little by little, we began taking back in to the sort of curtilage of the house and making a garden. So that was my introduction. But even at that stage, I have to confess, I did rather see gardening as outdoor housework, but simply sort of nicer to be outside than indoors. And it wasn't until our youngest child was 5 and began going to school that I started to have an urge to have a small plot within our plot of my own and begin to experiment and grow things myself. And I'd always loved cooking, so that was my way in. I started to grow culinary herbs and herbs that you could use for making teas with as well. And I got hooked by that. I just loved it. And the fact I could produce things that you couldn't possibly buy in a supermarket that tasted delicious and so on was a real thrill, actually. And from that, I kind of went on to vegetable gardening quite quickly. And that's become my annual thing that I do every year is grow as much veg as I can for us to eat.
Oh, man. I mean, I think anybody who's gardened knows once you have fresh homegrown lettuce and fresh, you know, right off the vine tomatoes, it's very hard to go back to store-bought. There's such a distinct difference.
It is, isn't it? I think it's something also that's so important, which is not only the amazing difference in taste, as it were, but also the real sense of satisfaction of having a hand in the making of this, you know, this form of nourishment. You know, I think it gives us such a direct relationship with the origins of life. You know, this is all life on earth is ultimately sustained through plants, or almost all life forms on earth are. And we take part in the cycle of life when we're gardening.
Do you have upcoming travel to a different country scheduled, or maybe you have a relative or a friend who speaks a different language that you want to connect with on a deeper level? Why not easily learn a new language with my favorite language learning tool, Rosetta Stone? I recently went to Italy and I brushed up on my Italian by using the Rosetta Stone app for like 20 minutes every morning. It was so easy to use. It was part of my morning practice. It was really fun. And let me tell you, Rosetta Stone works. It brushed me up so good. I was getting around Italy easily speaking Italian after putting those reps in. If you don't already know, Rosetta Stone is the trusted language learning tool available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered. It makes language learning so fun, so easy, and so fast. It immerses you in the language, which is the fastest way to learn. So it's an intuitive process with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language. It even coaches you on pronunciation with its true accent feature, which is like basically having a physical trainer for your accent. It's so wild. The desktop and app options make it so easy to do consistently, and it's an amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages forever for any and all trips and language needs in your entire life. So this year I brushed up on my Italian, but next year Billy and I want to go to Japan so we could learn conversational Japanese with it. That's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone has to offer, and right now they're offering 50% off. It's an insane steal. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Growing Joy with Plants listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life, plant friends. It's an insane deal. Redeem 50% off at Rosetta, R-O-S-E-T-T-A, stone.com/today. Absolutely. And I feel like herbs and vegetables also are such a gateway drug for so many people, for lack of a better word. You know, people who maybe aren't interested in plants, aren't interested in growing things, they can make sense of the practicality of growing food that you can consume, you know, and then that opens the door to houseplants or landscaping or, you know, other, you know, learning the trees. Like, I do think they're such a gentle introduction to plants. And yes, the concept that everything is living. And meanwhile, you're doing this garden and you're a practicing psychologist. Where does your specialty lie there?
I qualified as a medical doctor. I then went on and became a psychiatrist. And then following that, I trained as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist. So I'm actually both. And you're right, throughout all that time when we were setting up our garden here and raising our family, I was training and then became a consultant in my 40s locally and ran a psychotherapy service in Hertfordshire, where I live, for 13 years until I left the NHS. And then more recently, I've been working with a not-for-profit service called Doc Health that supports doctors suffering from stress and burnout and other mental disorders, you know, depression and so on. And that work's obviously been extremely busy in the last year and a bit with the pandemic.
I can't imagine. A few of our Patreon supporters are, you know, in the medical field, and I've heard brief insights into what that experience has been like. And I truly can't imagine what living through this pandemic must be like for doctors. So that sounds like amazing work. And what's so prevalent in your book is how uniquely qualified you are with your background in understanding human psyche and your experience with plants to like truly speak to the plant person connection. And man, how important it is and how real it is. Cause I think, you know, so many of us have this experience when we start caring for plants. I mean, obviously you're more outdoors. My podcast, my experience is primarily indoors with houseplants. But we all start to have those experiences when we're caring for plants that we realize, oh man, this is deeper. This is more than just watering a plant and keeping it alive. This is life lessons in this container. This is routine. This is joy. You know, plant care is so much deeper than that. And that's so prevalent in your book. Is that something that came naturally to you as you were tending the garden and you were, you know, seeing clients, or has that view needed to take time to be distilled in your mind?
Oh, it certainly took time. And I think for most of the time, my gardening was something, you know, which I did at home. And I became increasingly aware that as I took on more responsibility at work, particularly with running a service, therefore more stress, that if I'd been gardening at the weekend, you know, and had that time, that peace and quiet in the garden, been whatever, focused on weeding or potting up seedlings and sort of feeling I was doing something creative in the garden, that actually I returned to work refreshed. I noticed that, but I didn't sort of at that point take it any further. It really wasn't until 2013 when Christopher Woodward, who is the director of the Garden Museum in London, asked me to give a talk at a festival he wanted to launch. It was a summer festival for about gardening literature, gardening and new books about gardening. And he wanted to trial it in our garden at the barn at home. And Tom and I were very keen to do that. And we had a sort of preliminary meeting with him. And that's when he sort of sprung this idea that I would give a talk about gardening for the mind on me. And I immediately thought, oh, yes, I think I could do that. But I can honestly say until that point, it hadn't occurred to me to sort of bring these two sides of my life together. I'm not quite sure why. You know, I think it was because gardening for me was deeply personal, something very sustaining, very nourishing. But I hadn't put them together like that. As soon as I did, I realized how fruitful it was for me really to do that. And sort of all sorts of connections established themselves quite quickly in my mind. And I think possibly under the surface, I had been sort of thinking about this for quite some time, but not particularly aware of it. It felt to me as if, you know, something sort of sprang into life at that point, you know, a seed was sown. And I then set about shaping a book, putting together a book proposal, then selling the idea. And then it took me 5 years to actually write the book because I really wanted to go into it in depth. I looked to see if there was a book like the one I wanted to write, and there was one. And I felt there was a lot that hadn't been said, really, because I think it's very widely acknowledged that gardening is good for you, that it can give people hope or a sense of motivation. And that obviously it's sort of also good for physical health in terms of exercise and getting out in the fresh air and the sunlight and so on. But I found that there was a great deal lacking about the much more unconscious aspects of gardening in terms of, I think, the sort of symbolic meaning we can find in a garden through working with the life cycle. And also the neuroscience. You know, quite quickly as I started to look into it, I realized that there was a whole world of research, a lot of it that's been carried out in the last 10 years or so, and very exciting, very important research into the benefits of nature on us, and also things like soil bacteria and so on. So I wanted to bring all these things together. So the book, in a way, the book is very much a weaving together of all these different strands, including, as you mentioned, my own experiences in the garden, as well as some of the stories, you know, the stories of the people I interview on the research projects that I visited.
Yeah, I don't want to fangirl too much about the book, but what I was going to say is how beautifully you weave in between a profound understanding of the research and the studies. And I'm sure your years in kind of the academia side of it, being able to interpret that combined with personal anecdotes and stories of people. And it's really just a super compelling read. And I see myself, you know, in every page of it. And so what I'd love to talk to you about today are some of these studies, because as I embark on my own project that may or may not be written and may or may not have consulted with you on, that I can't quite talk about yet, the thing that I just so admire in your book is your grasp of these studies and the science, because there is so much science to back these feelings that I feel like we all inherently know and can explain. And I think also, like, there's finally like funding available to really start exploring. So if you don't mind, I'd love to talk about some of the concepts discussed in your book and kind of dive in on some of these studies.
Yeah, let's do that.
So the first off, I mean, this is probably the most fascinating concept to me personally. I know that it's not a diagnosed disorder yet. I know that it's more of a theory than an actual like diagnosed thing, but there is research surfacing about it. And that's the concept of plant blindness. I know personally, I definitely experienced plant blindness and came out of it when I went from being a plant killer to plant lady. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about like what your interpretation of plant blindness is and what those symptoms would kind of look like.
There are two aspects to plant blindness. One is cultural and one is, if you like, sort of, I suppose, environmental stroke neurological. But I think let's just start with the concept itself and the term, which was coined in the late 90s, so quite a long time ago. And it was two American biologists who were botanists, James Wandersee and Elizabeth Schussler, who wrote about their concern, actually, about how people didn't notice plants in their environments, particularly in urban environments. And what they were suggesting back then already was simply that within the societies that we live in, and the economic systems that we live in, plants have lost a sense of relevance or value to our everyday life, which of course is actually ridiculous, because you only have to look at most of the food and almost all the food in the supermarkets, everything has come from plants. So that's on the one hand, a sort of cultural aspect to it. And what they thought was that this is in a way amplified by the fact that the way our brains process environmental stimuli is that we're more likely to attend to something that's moving, for example, something that grabs our attention. And the plants in their very nature, by growing slowly, by being rooted in the soil, they don't grab our attention necessarily. Although I think flowers often do. I don't think it's entirely true. I think flowers absolutely do speak very directly to the visual cortex. So what they said is that people need to have their eyes opened to plants, to see them and to value them. And they also coined another term that I like, which is the plant mentor. And the idea that for most of us, our introduction to the plant kingdom, and whether that's, you know, as an observer of the natural world or as a sort of horticulturalist, getting your hands in the soil, really only comes about through learning from another person. You know, in traditional societies, this kind of knowledge was handed down within families, extended families, from one generation to another. And I was very struck by that, because I think that rings so true. And, you know, I know in my own family, it was my grandfather's love of gardening. You know, he passed that on to my mother, and certainly feel somewhere in me, you know, that was there. It was like a dormant seed too. which was reawakened when I began my own gardening later on. So I think this idea of the plant mentor is very important in relation to how we might think about introducing people to plants in schools, for example, in therapeutic gardening projects. You know, for many people, the horticultural therapist is that figure who opens the door for them into the world of plants.
So many aspects of it are so interesting to me. Let me preface this whole thing by saying I don't love the idea that the concept of blindness is used. We're referencing this because this is the accepted name for this, but you know, it's not like you can wake up from blindness, and I want to acknowledge sensitivity there, but I had the experience of what these scientists are calling plant blindness the majority of my life as I started caring for them successfully and stopped killing them, which is what I did for the majority of my adult experience through the help of my mom. And ironically, for me, a big plant mentor was the internet and Googling and connecting with people on social media who helped. All of a sudden, I noticed every tree on my street. All of a sudden, I noticed the, you know, 40-year-old Hoya plant that was 5 feet tall in the nail salon on my corner that I had never noticed before. And it felt like this awakening. Like it felt all of a sudden I saw green, like the color green for the first time. And it was a very interesting time in my life where all of a sudden I was kind of waking up to the like miraculous, I don't know, to life, to plants. And I just thought that concept really captures it. And I know that so many of us struggle with it as we become more and more disconnected from the food chain, more and more disconnected from plants or cultivating anything as we live in apartments and no one has lawns anymore and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's so interesting.
I think the other thing that is involved in this is the feeling, as you say, it's not noticing. So that's there. So almost you don't know that it's going on because you don't notice it. You don't notice the fact that you're not noticing, if you like. But then the other element is that plants can feel very alien, because if nobody's introduced you to this world, if you don't feel comfortable with the idea of getting your hands in the soil and touching plants and so on, it can feel really quite intimidating. And that's another reason for the role of the plant mentor. And I think what you say about the internet is also so true today. And I think during the pandemic, when people have been, you know, experiencing social isolation en masse, of course, that's really come into its own. Disseminating information and knowledge in that way has been a lifeline, hasn't it, for many people who have experienced in this time of sort of, you know, stopping our lives. So many aspects of our lives have been put on hold, and people have, you know, had to stay very closely to this, you know, their home environment and their neighborhood. But actually, people have begun in some cases to really notice a bit more what's around them and to notice nature. So I think it's been a very interesting period because of that in relation to our disconnection from nature.
Yeah. And it's time, baby, time to reconnect.
It is time. And I, you know, for all the great trauma of the pandemic and the terrible losses of many different kinds that people have experienced and the anxiety and fear that's been involved, I think one thing that has come out of it very strongly for many people is an understanding of the importance of nature for our emotional well-being. And, you know, there's a great deal of solace and consolation that can be found through the natural world and you know, the other sort of species that surround us. Because I know we've been talking mainly about plants, but of course, you know, there's been a great deal of interest in bird watching, for example, during the pandemic. And people just having time to notice the butterflies that visit their garden and to sort of value them in a new way, things like that.
Thank you, Soltech Solutions, for sponsoring today's episode. Plant friends, we know I love Soltech Solutions. I have three of their aspect pendant style hanging lights, grow lights in my apartment. I have two of their Vita Grow bulbs. And now they have amazing bundles on their website that can save you up to $100 if you are interested in getting your first light, or if you are interested in potentially installing a grow wall. They've actually partnered with Wally Grow and they have really fun like green wall bundles as well. So whether you're starting out or whether you have a collection of plants and you need to up level, Soltech Solutions decor grow lights allow you to keep your plants healthy and happy, all while fitting seamlessly seamlessly and beautifully into your home decor. Truly, I've got the VitaGrow bulb on my desk in a desk lamp, and their aspect lights like look like any other normal, modern, sleek, sexy light in anyone's home. And they've got a bunch of different bundles depending on what you need for your home. But I really love that they have like this green wall bundle where you can get their track lighting system. And it comes with the Wally Grow Eco Planters that you've also heard about in other episodes. And so it's like a one-stop shop for your own green wall, which I love. Or if you don't have one of their aspect pendant lights, you gotta get one. And they have a couple of bundles surrounding those too. So if you're interested in getting one of those bundles, you can save up to 20% off at soltechsolutions.com with no coupon code necessary. They're just making these bundles as appealing as possible. So head over to soltechsolutions.com, check out their bundle section for all of the different offerings they have, and save up to 20% off. Everything's linked in the show notes as well. I mean, houseplants do this as well, but also I think the scope and the perspective that nature can give you, that a tree, I used to have this thought a lot, but even before I was a plant lady, I'm from Italy and I would go to my family home in Italy and we're surrounded by the Dolomites. And I'd look at these mountains and I'd see the remnants of old castles that are, you know, so old. And I would have these thoughts of like, these mountains were here long before me and they're going to be here long after I'm gone. So like, what scope of my problems? Like, what do my problems even matter when you think about it? And I think when you look at like huge trees or when you look at plants that have just been around for so long, I do think it helps assuage those fears that you talk about of recognizing like in the grand scheme of things, everything moves forward, right? And I do very strongly feel that plants, whether they're on your windowsill or the tree outside your window, can give you that perspective, which is more important than ever. These concepts, which is what I want to talk to you about next, like my mantra for 2020, I mean, we all had hard 2020s. There's so many lessons to be learned through plants. For me in 2020, I had a rough year. My life basically flipped, you know, 180 degrees. My home changed, my job changed, my wedding was postponed, a lot of significant change in my life. My mantra was, after pruning comes new growth, after pruning comes new growth. And that was just kind of what I lived by every day, of just trusting that would happen. And what I loved in your book too is you had so many amazing kind of garden life parallels. I want to read a snippet. One of my favorite quotes from your book is, "In tending a plot and nurturing and caring for plants, we are constantly faced with disappearance and return." What are other garden life parallels that really resonate with you that you've used in the course of your life or maybe with patients?
I think the main thing is exactly what you describe. I think the feeling of the continuity of life on the one hand, but also being in touch with the transience and the fragility of life. I think the garden, you can see it, you know, I quote Stanley Kunitz, the poet in the book, who discusses it as a kind of parable of the human life, these experiences of disappearance and return, the life cycle of the flower and so on. He sees the compost heap as a metaphor too, you know, that reminds us that ultimately we're all destined for the compost heap. So I think there are many, many different ways, but I think it's one of those things that it's not always helpful to kind of completely spell it out, because I think it's just something that happens alongside your experience in the garden. You know, it gives you something to hold on to, a belief, you know, as you were describing very movingly earlier about sort of pruning and new growth, you know, a belief in change, in the cycle coming round again. And my own experience has been very similar to that. And I quote other people in my book, some real life examples of that, that gardening can restore that faith. And I think particularly help people come out of very significant experiences of trauma or loss, in which that can be very hard to do. You know, it can feel as if the world has come to an end in some way, or you know, the future looks very, very bleak. And I think gardening can give a very simple way to begin to think about the future as well. Because I was struck, you were talking about trees and the kind of, you know, those aspects of nature that are enduring and how stabilizing that can be. But the other aspects in the garden is a different kind of temporality. It's, you know, it's that, let's say, sowing seeds and how quickly, if you sow a sunflower seed, you know, within months, you've got this giant sunflower potentially looking down on you even, you know, it may have grown taller than you. And, you know, that I certainly found that very helpful myself when I've sort of, you know, been in the periods of just finding it hard to get going, you know, procrastinating a lot with other things and so on. I think the different sort of timelines in a garden are also helpful in different ways.
Yeah. And seeds within themselves. I mean, another great quote from your book is like, seeds show the promise of tomorrow. What's that quote?
Seeds have tomorrow already built into them. I think that's right, because I do think that when you're sowing seeds, it absolutely triggers that sense of positive anticipation, you know, whether it's about the flowers, the beautiful flowers you're growing, or delicious fruits or vegetables, you know, a sense of goodness to come. And as I was saying, you know, when somebody's very stuck in their life and very anxious about the future, that can be enough to begin to unlock that sense of actually it's okay to, you know, to begin to plan for the future. So it's a sort of safe way to do it, isn't it? And an accessible way to do it as well.
That's beautiful.
Well, the gardens have given people during this period when, as you were highlighting, you know, so many things that people have been looking forward to, whether it's weddings or family gatherings or holidays, have been cancelled or postponed repeatedly. Gardening has given people a way of being able to plan their year a bit, you know, plan and shape a little bit of their life. And, you know, when the human world's been in such disarray, that's, I think, been invaluable for many people.
It's so interesting how gardeners, we love the control of the planning stage. And, you know, when I was stuck in my tiny apartment in COVID, going through all of this, I like maniacally planned my 9-square-foot balcony garden. Like, but it was so fun, you know, but it's funny how we think we have control and then we plant these plants and they like do whatever they want, which is a lesson in itself as well, like of trying to control and then letting go and surrendering.
Well, I think that, you know, you were talking about life lessons. I think, of course, that's the other great one, isn't it? That I think fundamentally, you know, it's easy to think about gardening as a hobby or an activity, but I think it's actually a relationship. And like all relationships, you know, there's a to and fro aspect to it. There's a kind of, it's a sort of dance that goes on. You know, we intervene a bit. We do our caring, our nurturing. But as you say, the plant will do its own thing as well. There's definitely a sort of, you know, responding to each other that goes on and noticing, you know, that you have to notice what's happening with your plants and attend to them accordingly. And I think very importantly as well, it's a simplified form of nurture in that way. You know, I mean, plants can, of course, be very, very delicate and tricky, you know, depending on what you grow. So it's not always easy, but it is more simple, I think, because, you know, we plants don't have, as Freud put it, actually, he said, flowers have neither conflicts nor emotions. And he was a real flower lover.
Yeah, that was a fun fact I learned in your book, is that Freud was a total plant daddy.
He really was, actually. It's very little known fact about his life. And, you know, there's another psychoanalyst, Harold Searles, the American psychiatrist and psychoanalyst, who was writing in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, he highlighted the fact, he put it something like this, that, you know, it's as if we sometimes think about ourselves as, you know, like humans alone in the universe, you know, that we don't value relationships with other species and other forms of life enough. You know, we're so human-centric in our thinking, and particularly in our psychological theories, which is what he was trying to redress. And, you know, he was one of the first people in recent times to write about how much emotional support people can experience through, for example, you know, forming a connection with a tree. You know, he wrote about patients in hospital who would gaze at trees for long periods of time and get a great deal of comfort from that. And he also wrote about stones, you know, that concept of endurance, that people can feel very reassured by having proximity to a part of nature that has endured for such a long time, you know, has been around much longer than our own lifetime and will persist for much, much, much longer after as well.
Well, and that ties right into another concept you write about, which is rather well known, but biophilia by E.O. Wilson, which is basically saying that as humans, we've evolved around nature and we're innately kind of hardwired to want to be there, right? Whether it's anything natural, a stone, a view of water, a view of nature, but that we're kind of predisposed to want to be in nature and not necessarily want to be in these like tiny apartments we all live in, right? Like that's not where we evolved. That's a super interesting concept as well.
It's actually very interesting in the current, you know, the context, the period that we're living through, because there's a phrase that was coined by the socio-ecologist Keith Tidball, urgent biophilia. He's described this in numerous different settings, but all in the aftermath of various forms of crisis, whether that's in war zones, communities recovering from the aftermath of war, or recovering from various forms of natural disaster. And what he describes is actually how those kinds of crisis when our lives are absolutely completely thrown into upheaval seems to trigger a real awakening of biophilia. So that there's an urgent need, and that actually in terms of the rebuilding that needs to go on, you know, things like planting trees, for example, can really give people a sense of hope for the future and sort of kickstart, I think, an investment in the future in the face of what might otherwise feel hopeless. There's no doubt that, you know, we've been living through a time of urgent biophilia. For many people, I mean, I don't think one can generalize totally, but this pandemic has really triggered that around the world, I think.
I'm a classic example. I went from living in a tiny apartment in New York City and I moved to a cabin in the woods.
Oh, gosh, so you really did. You really did. I also think the other thing is that, you know, it's so important not to forget the people who've not had access to nature or to plants during this extremely difficult and stressful time. You know, certainly in the UK, we know that 1 in 8 people live in homes that have no outdoor space at all. And enduring lockdown in that situation is, you know, immeasurably more stressful. You know, even if you've got a balcony where you can grow things and you can look at the sky and listen to the birds, as it were.
Absolutely. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I do want to ask you to talk about one last thing that I have obsessed with from your book and through reading it in your book and doing further research on my own. I mean, this is a practice that I am doing routinely these days, which is exploring my scent and plants and the brain in terms of the plant person connection. Because I've got the visual thing, I've got a lot of house plants, I've got the sensory, the touch thing, I repot them. You know, I can, with the other senses, I've never really considered scent so much beyond just like smelling, enjoying my basil and lavender. But a new practice that I do is I go for post-rain walks because of these studies that you shared about geosmin, petrichor, and Microbacteria vaccae. So would you kind of elaborate so our listeners might be able to experiment with that? And I can kind of share after, you know, how I've been interpreting it and practicing.
Yes, absolutely. So geosmin is the smell of wet earth, and it derives from the bacteria, the actinomycetes in the earth. And it's a smell that we are, as a species, very, very sensitive to. And it has a sort of calming and pleasurable effect on most people. So we're kind of drawn towards it. And, you know, the explanation for this is sort of widely accepted to be an evolutionary one, in that, you know, surroundings where there was running water and therefore wet earth, but also maybe plentiful rain, would have been conducive to survival. So, you know, it's the instinct to sniff out a source of water, if you like, that is speaking to us. And at some level saying to us, you know, this is a good place to be. When you were talking about biophilia earlier, you were talking about E.O. Wilson and the idea that biophilia at some level is encoded in our genes. And, you know, I think it's our lifestyles are so removed from the natural world now. It's important not to underestimate, you know, the power of evolution on shaping us, and the fact that for so much of our development, the entire, you know, everything that took our evolution to the emergence of Homo sapiens and, you know, our nervous systems, our brains and so on, is entirely about the way that we have adapted to live in the natural world. And you know, our brains are primed to respond to various natural stimuli. And, you know, most people understand about sunlight and vitamin D, for example. But actually, in spite of that, there's very high levels in cities and in children in schools in urban environments of, you know, seriously low levels of vitamin D, which are detrimental to health. So we have removed ourselves and I think stopped valuing those kind of basic, really basic health needs, you know, not really attending to them. And one of those, which is, I think, less well recognized, is to do with beneficial bacteria. So what's become clear in, through, you know, microbiological research and other research studies is that we co-evolved as a species with certain bacteria, which, you know, have been coined, the term friendly bacteria has been coined. You know, they're our old friends. And these bacteria perform certain functions largely within our gut for us. So this is a kind of symbiotic relationship. And our environments generally have become depleted of these bacteria. And also we, you know, we come to see bacteria, we're at risk of seeing them as sort of universally bad, if you like, you know. And of course, with COVID, we've been sterilizing more and more, you know, and so on, you know, so that's been necessary, but it's symptomatic of this sense that, you know, there's a lot of danger in these microorganisms. But there are also good ones, there are also beneficial ones. And soil bacteria in particular can be beneficial to us. One study I quote in the book is one that showed that gardeners had a wider variety of gut bacteria than non-gardeners. And variety is, when it comes to the microbiome, is health, really. The more diverse the population of bacteria in your gut, generally the rule is that the better that is for you. That's one way that gardening can help our health. The other aspect in relation to soil bacteria, which is a very exciting development, and there's still a lot of research going into this, is about the Mycobacterium vaccae that you mentioned. And studies indicate that this bacteria seems to be able to trigger release of serotonin in the brain. And actually, Christopher Lowry's laboratory, which is where the research originated, is now looking at this as a potential treatment for post-traumatic stress, for example. So I think there are, you know, there are many levels. I think we are just beginning to uncover the real complexity of our relationship with the natural world. And in saying that, of course, you know, I hear myself saying it, and I think, but, you know, of course, the point is we are part of nature too. So how do we talk about this thing? You know, how do we separate ourselves from it and comment on it? And actually, really, you know, physiologically, we've evolved in a way in which we're embedded in it and really need some contact for our health. You know, it's not as if we do need to return to nature. The studies on the anti-stress effects of green nature, for example, show that 30 minutes, a dose of 30 minutes is enough to have a beneficial impact.
Totally. I mean, it's all stuff we innately know, and it's super exciting that the studies are starting to come out. Or they've come out and they're just being proven and over and over again that, man, this, it's important. And, you know, we've barely scratched the surface of what you write about in your book. I highly recommend anybody with any interest in the plant-person connection pick up a copy of it. So can you share with us a little bit about the book, The Well-Gardened Mind? We'll link to it in the show notes. But where can people find you if they want to keep tabs on you and any other exciting things about the book?
Well, I'm on Instagram and Twitter, just at Sue Stewart Smith without the hyphen. And I have a website as well. I recorded the book as an audiobook if people are interested in listening to that. So I think those are probably, yeah, the main routes. And I would encourage people, if they want to buy the book, to, you know, support their local independent bookstore.
Absolutely. And it's in 15 languages. So, you know, we have a lot of international listeners. So maybe it's in your native language. But thank you so much, Sue. This was such a great talk. Thank you for this book. It's been so amazing. It was an amazing read. I'm sure that I'll be returning to it in the future because it's just so chock full of so many interesting things. And I hope to have you back on the show again in the future to talk about updated studies and more research that comes out.
Great. Thank you. It's been really, really lovely talking to you, Marin.
Thanks, Sue. Thank you so much, Sue, for this fantastic conversation. She's just a classy lady, super smart, and so fun that we kind of got to dive into some of those studies that we talked about, some of those larger concepts. I will be bringing something very exciting to you guys in 2022. Hint, hint. I wonder if you can guess. That kind of expands on this. And Sue's been super helpful to me as I've been in my own journey with that. But man, this book is amazing. I highly recommend it. It's called The Well-Gardened Mind. It's in many languages, as Sue mentioned. It is linked in the show notes. Get it at your local bookstore near you. And support Sue. Go give her a follow on socials. I can't wait to read her next book, but we'll give her some time to process before the next book comes out. And I hope, plant friends, that you are enjoying the spring if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. I hope that you are getting outside, breathing some fresh air, enjoying some soil, getting your hands dirty, and just enjoying the growth that surrounds you, no matter what season of life you're in, truly. I hope plants are helping you be more connected and mindful in your life. It's really just what I want everyone to do, is just make the world a kinder and greener place. So until next time, my sweet plant friends, I hope to see you in the garden party. And until then, keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're there subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section and leave us a review? It would be tremendously helpful for the show, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more planty content or ways to help and support the show or engage with our community, we've got a ton of options for you. So first, there's the free Bloom and Grow Plant Parent Personality Test. It is a super fun 3-minute test that I made for you that pairs you with your plant parent personality profile, where you'll learn your planty strengths and weaknesses and get a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you. The test lives at bloomandgrowradio.com/personality, and you have to let me know what your results are on Instagram. You can find me on Instagram at Bloom and Grow Radio. If you're interested in supporting Bloom and Grow Radio, consider becoming a Patreon plant friend of the show. Patreon plant friends are members of the community who support the show monetarily on a monthly basis for as little as $4 a month, and these magical humans help support the show and bring our content to as many planty eyes and ears as possible. Once you join, you'll also get the secret password to our Facebook group, which I like to call the plantiest corner of the internet. We have a lot of fun over there. You can become a Patreon plant friend at patreon.com/bloomandgrowradio. And of course, you can also just join our newsletter that I like to call the Garden Club. When you join our Garden Club, you'll receive a free download of the exclusive Molly Mansfield Keep Blooming print, which is so adorable. And I'll slide into your inboxes, usually only around twice a month, with plant care tips, recent episodes, and announcements. You can join at bloomandgrowradio.com/community. And for anything else, plant friends, I'm here for you. So feel free to drop me a line when you have an idea for an episode, an event, or maybe even if you're a planty business interested in sponsoring the show. Thanks again for listening. It is my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the society yet, plant friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions, like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group, so if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will will pop up. So you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test. Because, plant friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little plant parent personality quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right house plants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.